The Last Word on Today FM with Matt Cooper.
Now, you're very welcome back to The Last Word with me, Frank Graney, filling in for Matt Cooper on the show this evening. And my next guest has quite the story to share with us today. His name is Philip Whitcomb, and while that may not ring any bells, his birth name might, particularly his surname. Philip was born Roberto Sendoya Escobar, the first child of notorious Colombian drug lord Pablo Escobar, who became one of the richest men on the planet through his criminal empire and controlled 80% of the global cocaine trade before he was shot dead in 1993. I'm delighted to say that Philip joins us now to discuss his new book, Son of Escobar, Firstborn. Good evening, Philip.
Good evening. How are you this evening?
I'm very well, thanks. Thanks for joining us. Now, I'm very eager to know how you felt. You've been described as Pablo's secret son, and I'm very eager to know how you felt when you first found out who your father was. But let's go back a bit first, and let's begin by talking about what could only be described as your dramatic start to life and how you found yourself in the care of an MI6 agent.
Yes. Well, obviously, you know, at a very early age, you don't remember these things. But there was a moment in the history of my life in 1989 when my adopted father, the MI6 secret agent with a license to kill, just like in the movies, decides to tell me who my real father is. And because he decided to tell me that then, he's then got to go back in history, because I'm asking him, what about this woman in the red dress I keep seeing in my nightmares? So he has to go back and tell me what it was all about, because I wouldn't let it go. And I kept hassling him. And I was 24 at the time, so I'm a grown up now. And so he eventually reluctantly tells me the story, which I've written in great detail in the book. It's a very sad situation where, in reality, what happens is you've got these gangs robbing cars and robbing banks and I don't know what else going on in Colombia in the early 60s. And unfortunately, they decide to pick on the British Armored Car Service and secure printing operations in Colombia. And they rob one of the armored cars of Thomas de la Rue. And these are professionals, you know, with, you know, armed special forces protecting their backs. And of course, that was a mistake. They hid the money in a village outside Bogota. And they're just a gang of thieves at the time. This is before the cartels. My book is a prequel to Narcos. And they hid the money in this house, in the sacks that they'd actually stolen out of the armored cars. And the intel got back to the MI6 agent, and he and his counterpart from the CIA mounted a vicious operation to teach these people a lesson and go back and get the money. And they landed in the village, you know, in the helicopters, and there was a big shootout. Two people survived, one gangster and another gangster, and the two of them were young lads, just teenagers, and one of them was a chap called Pablo Escobar, who was a nobody. And in the house, there was a young girl dying. She'd copped a bullet by accident. And the woman in the red dress in my nightmares turned out to be my mother, who actually was covered in blood, not a red dress. And that's what I'd seen, and that's how it was explained to me. The secret agent picks up, promises the young girl she dies that he will look after them. So he picks up the little boy and takes him to an orphanage in Colombia. And on the front of the book, the church you see on the bottom there is actually my orphanage. And that's where I was taken. There's another whole set of circumstances surrounding why I was actually adopted, but that's part of the story.
Well, and I want to ask you about that. I want to ask you about the MI6 agent then rescued you, because this was to be your adopted father, Patrick, and he brought you initially to an orphanage, as you've mentioned, but then he came and he adopted you. And you don't doubt your adopted father's love for you, but you did raise some eyebrows looking back as to, I suppose, why he came back for you.
Yes, obviously the adoption is now a bigger issue. He's rescued me and put me in an orphanage, so he's done the thing he said he would do. But the adoption becomes a bigger issue surrounding the powers of the country and how they decide they want to deal with matters. And it turns out that they use the little boy, which is me, as a bit of a pawn, a game in a much bigger game, where they can get control of a situation. So when they find out that, you know, the gang, the guy that escaped from the gang had this little boy was his kid, and that's because Uncle Carlos, who I used to call, it was an Escobar, you know, found out all this. And so what happened was is that they used the little boy in a pawn, like a kind of it's a bit difficult to determine who was doing the kidnapping in a sense. But I was taken to Medellin as this chap became more powerful and used to kind of influence his authority.
And as you mentioned, you were brought to meet your father. You weren't to know that he was your father at that time. Yeah. You were a child. You were brought to meet him on a number of occasions. What do you remember about those meetings?
Well, they were very uneasy. When you're a child, you see through a different, you see things through a different light. You see, you don't understand what's going on as a child. And I didn't know what was going on. And when I was very young, I just sort of did as I was told, and you just do it, you know. And we were in this big ballroom, and my bodyguards, who were my friends effectively, were with me. And, you know, we were told to go and sit at this front table. And I sat next to this man who I didn't know who he was, but, you know, I had to sit there for about 20 minutes. And whilst he talked to his friends, and, you know, there was this kind of very uneasy situation for me. I didn't enjoy it. And I felt intimidated, but, you know, it was something that had to be done. And I remember him putting his hand on my shoulder, telling me to remember I'm always an Escobar. And I couldn't understand what he was on about because I was just a little kid. But I remember it, and it's very surreal, but also intimidating and scary. The thing I remember about the guy the most was his smell. He had a smell of sort of a mixture of what I now know to be hashish and sort of cologne, that kind of stuff. And he was a rough and ready fellow back in the early days. And he swathed himself up a bit when he was going for political office, but he was rough and ready and very intimidating.
And he would have described himself as a man dedicated to his family. Did he ever make any attempt to bring you back into the fold?
Well, yes. I mean, this was part of the problems and why I was sent to England and turned into a little Englishman, because I was sent to boarding school in England because there were several kidnap attempts. And it turned out they were from this gang in Medellin. And I describe those in great detail in the book because they are firsthand experiences of the horror of, you know, shootouts and dogs chewing on, you know, it's just terrible, terrible experience. And my guard dog was a nasty thing. And, you know, he attacked the kidnapper in one of the attempts. And I found it all very, very distressing. And it still causes me distress today.
And what age would you have been at that stage?
Well, there were different moments, obviously, in my life when these attempts happened. One of the most memorable one was in 1970. It was just before I went to boarding school. Okay. And it was around the time where there was a military coup in Colombia. Well, almost a military coup. And there was a lot of violence going on in the streets. And this man broke into our house and they discovered where he'd come from. Mm-hmm. They very nearly got me. You know, it was really close. But again, the trauma of watching my bodyguard shoot this guy dead in front of me, you know, when you're like 7 or 8 years old, you just, it's shocking.
Of course.
The sound of gunfire inside a house is incredible. You know, it's absolutely shocking.
So let's move on then. And you might tell us about that moment when you finally found out who your real father was. And I wonder, did the name Pablo Escobar resonate with you at that time?
No, not at all. In 1989, I'm living on the Costa del Sol with my wife and two children. And I was designing a golf course with Peter Alice on the Alcaidesa golf course near Soto Grande. And we were just getting on with our lives. I knew that I had an interesting past and I knew that I'd been adopted and all this stuff by now. But I didn't know who Pablo Escobar was. I mean, there's no internet, no Google and none of that. We just, you know. So Dad calls me up from Madrid. He's running his operation through Madrid now. And he calls me up and I go up to visit him. And we have this conversation. Well, it starts there. I mean, it goes on for 2 or 3 years eventually, but it starts there. And it's because Don Pablo Escobar has lost control of his business and he's now in a prison, well, a homemade prison, but he's, you know, he's losing control. And, you know, any family member's danger. And so what happened was is that Dad got me security and bodyguards again. So, but he started to tell me the story of my life and who Escobar was, and I didn't know who he was. It just didn't mean anything to me until we started to get information through from the internet and stuff that I realized who the guy was and why Dad had been so careful to look after me.
And how did that feel when you started to learn more about this man that you now know knew to be your father? I mean, given the fact that he was responsible for killing thousands of people, including judges, police officers, journalists and government officials, that must have come as quite a shock to the system.
Yeah, a massive shock. Obviously, I knew the man was always surrounded by guns, and I witnessed him handing bags of cash over to my adopted father, and I knew that it was all guns and I don't know what, but that Colombia was a bit like that. So you take that in your stride. But then later as an adult, as you rightly ask, you know, how did I feel? It's shocking. But it's not only shocking, it's all a bit worrying, because you don't know that it's the not knowing that's the worry. You know, what's going to happen next? You can't tell. You just don't know. So, you know, it was a bit worrying at the time, I must say. And, you know, I've got two little children and, oh, God, you know. So it was a little bit, it was concerning. But things have calmed down now. We're okay.
And I wonder, did you become obsessed then with learning about Pablo Escobar when you realised that he was your father? You know, did you spend, I know you spoke about how it was difficult back in the time to find out information, but you must have been very curious.
Well, I'll tell you what, I sort of went into denial for quite a long time and just didn't bother with it because I got on with my life. But in 1993, which is a key year here in the story of my life, my adopted father sadly died of motor neurone disease in January, and my beloved wife died of a brain tumor in July, and then my real father gets shot in the head in December. And 93 was a hell of a year. But, you know, this answers your question. I went into a bout of depression, which, you know, I had to deal with over the years. And I became very, very ill. And the therapy was to write this down. It wasn't the target to be a book. It was just to get it all out on paper. And to answer your question in detail, of course, it wasn't an obsession as such, but you have to research the person you're writing about. So the research started in 94, but my illness wouldn't let me keep writing all the time. And so it was on and off from there up until today. And but the research started then, you know, back in 94, 95. And, you know, I was still researching my own life story through newspaper cuttings and memories and photographs and postcards and all the stuff that you use to research a book, right up until the last, you know, year or so, which is, you know, last year. So there's many, many, many years of hard work gone into this book.
And how, I know you didn't have a close connection clearly with the man, but how did you feel when you learned that he had been shot dead in 93, as you mentioned?
Yeah, I remember watching the news. I'd just had some dinner, and my wife had had her operation, which wasn't successful, but she'd had her operation, and she died, and it was very sad. And I remember having dinner and watching the news, and remembering, but it really wasn't sad or anything. I was moved by the fact that he'd been killed. And it was a mixture of relief and indifference, to be honest. And it wasn't the shock of him being killed that was an issue. It was the shock of thinking that there was now going to be a new era of something that we didn't know. What's next?
He obviously amassed an awful lot of enemies during his relatively short life. Were you ever concerned that they would maybe come after you?
No, I wasn't concerned, because you've got to remember, I didn't know that he was my father. So when I discovered...
But later in life, when you discover, because I know, you know, your half-siblings, Manuela and Sebastian, they would have been targets for his enemies.
Yes, and they were, would have been. And I don't know quite how to put this, but to a certain degree, that's why I'm the secret son. And to a certain degree, it's comforting that they're still around, because... surely they would have been first on the list as being more notable and more visible to anybody who had a problem with them. Now they've not Manuela, but Juan Pablo has managed to meet other relatives and sort of it's the whole thing has been sort of quietened down a bit. So now I've just popped out the woodwork and I don't see or perceive a threat at all, because if there was going to be any problem, they would have gone after Juan Pablo a long time ago.
Yeah. And did you ever reach out to them at all?
Well, you know, there are problems. Look, he doesn't like me. He feels that, you know, let's be honest, he's not said some good things about me at all. And even today on publication day, I think he's talking badly about me. Look, I have nothing bad to say about the guy. You know, we're all victims here. He's a victim. He said he was a victim in his book. I agree with him. He's a victim of the father that he had. I'm a victim of the father that I had that, you know, gave birth to me. And we're all victims. And I feel that. That's bad, you know. We're never going to see eye to eye. He perceives me to be some kind of threat in some way. I don't understand what his problem is. So, but there we go. We just leave it at that. I'm mature and old enough to understand that, and that's fine. I'm sure he'll get over it. He needs to read the book. He'll find out that basically all I'm doing is telling a story about a kid who grew up in Colombia. But, you know, what's quite interesting is that we both grew up in a totally different part of the world, not knowing each other until knowing of each other either until very recently. And yet, quite interestingly enough, the two of us have grown up and ended up drawing for a living. I'm an artist,
yes,
and he's
right.
an architect. So do you not think that's quite interesting?
Yes, you're both very creative, obviously, and both working in the arts. And speaking of the arts, I want to ask you, and I hate to ask, but I have to ask, did you watch the Narcos series on Netflix? And if so, what did you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, I perceive the whole thing as an exciting drama, and it's been Hollywoodized. If there is such a word, and you have to accept that, and that's not a problem for me. Yes, they've got to make stuff up because they don't know the full story, but you know, that's fine. And it was entertaining and one of the world's most successful TV series. I can't knock it, can I? Obviously, there's a lot of stuff in there that's not true or whatever. That's not an issue. It was a very successful TV program and everybody loved it. What is interesting about Narcos is that it starts when Don Pablo Escobar is about 24, 25. There's this instant and almost unsaid assumption that this guy suddenly was a drug dealer. What my story does is complete the issue by telling the prequel to Narcos and how the drugs business began.
Yeah. I want to ask you finally then, I could talk to you all evening. You've got a very interesting story to tell. But clearly, by the time of his death, your father is said to have amassed about $30 billion, give or take. A fortune of that is said to be buried in various locations. And just before your adopted father, Patrick, died, he gave you a code to reveal its secret location. You clearly haven't cracked it yet if you're here talking to me about your book, but you have included it in the book.
I might be talking to you on a 200-foot yacht. You don't know.
very true. Tell us about this.
You're quite right to ask the question. Absolutely, no problem. So let's get just a couple of facts straight here for your listeners. The fortunes that were amassed, the billions, have been found. They were in the American invasion. Most of it was in the banks of Noriega's banks in Panama. Other bits have been found over the years here and there in barrels of God knows whatever. And so most of that money has been found. And, you know, there's this mystery about Escobar's secret missing millions, and it's right that they should be. Now, what happened is, you've got to remember that this book tells the story of the secret agent engaging in a relationship with this guy and tucking away personal money for him, converting it by inverting houses and all sorts of stuff, and helping him to gain his trust so that they could infiltrate the cartels. So this is separate money. This is about $1 billion worth of bullion and emeralds and stuff that is being hidden in four or five different locations by Pat Whitcomb on behalf of Pablo Escobar, who was getting money away from the cartels. This is his personal money that he was hiding. When Escobar's taken out, Don Pablo, then Pat Whitcomb's left with a problem with his money. So he he's already converted and hidden most of it. In Madrid, in the story, I saw about 210 million in currency. That gets converted into other stuff and hidden a couple of months after that. So we're looking at about roughly about $1 billion worth of bullion and emeralds and Baro bonds and that kind of thing in five different locations around the world. And the code, or five lines of code, which are, tell you where the money is, are in the book.
And you got those codes, that code from your father, Patrick, on his deathbed.
Yes. Yeah, and that last chapter was the hardest chapter to write, where I described the death of my father, and I was there on his bed at the time. And, I, you know, a dreadful, dreadful thing to watch such a powerful gentleman, half Irish and half English, loving father, and very, very steeled and honourable chap, and he's dying of this terrible disease. And in the last moments of his breath, he hands me a diary. And inside the diary is a piece of paper, and on the back of the paper is written these codes. Now, they have Masonic connotations, and each Masonic level has a motto. And the motto of the Masonic level is a pointer as to where the money is. But also the book itself will, if you study Patrick Whitcomb's movements and how he operated, that whole book itself encompasses the code and will help you work it out. Now, well, I've worked out certain areas, but not the full thing.
Well, if your fascinating and dramatic story isn't enough to sell some books, I'm sure the potential to find millions of Pablo Escobar's fortune will. Son of Escobar, Firstborn is the name of the book. Philip Whitcomb is the author, also known as Roberto Sendoya Escobar. Thank you very much for joining us on The Last Word this evening.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Listen live, on air, from 4:30 weekdays on Today FM.